Hey, everybody, welcome to the Daniel Davis Deep Dive Intel Brief, where we give you the best of the information that we learned this week to make sure that you don't miss anything that you need, to include what may have been happening here just in the last 24 hours or so. We've got some of both of that today, and let's just jump right into it. First of all, on Monday, we started off, you know, bright and early. Interesting comments coming out of Ukraine. So obviously this war has been going badly for the Ukraine side. Lots of issues about this 28-point peace plan that President Trump had been rumored to be having. We found out later on information that, yeah, it turned from 28 to 19. But on Monday, Zelensky fired a shot across the bow to make sure everybody knew where he stood.
It is crucial to support the principles on which Europe stands, that borders cannot be changed by force, that war criminals must not escape justice, and that the aggressor must pay fully for the war he started. And this is why decisions on Russian assets are essential.
You know how they do a lot of the AI videos where you can like pretend you're certain people. You can actually look like you're Barack Obama and you can say whatever you want. And the video will look like it's Barack Obama speaking in his voice and all that kind of stuff. If I told you that this was a modern day version of that, where Volodymyr Zelensky was mouthing the words that were spoken by the victorious allies in World War One, talking about the defeated Germany and how they were going to pay reparations and stuff, it would have been indistinguishable. Because that's how he's talking. That's the statement he's using. That's the language he's using. That's the imagery that he's trying to bring. One of power, talking to a defeated, vanquished foe, except it's on the other end. It would be as though we had the juxtaposition there and it was actually the defeated Germans who were making these bold statements. Of course, they would have been mocked and laughed off the stage. As the allies said, yeah, it doesn't matter what you say. We have the power. We will impose upon you, the defeated foe, what we want. Now, obviously, we can argue about how unwise that was. But nevertheless, the big point is here. This is so dysfunctional and just weird. I mean, if I can just use that terminology here. Because Ukraine is short on manpower. They're short on ammunition. The entire West, writ large, is short on the key ammunition parts, especially interceptor missiles, offensive missiles, artillery, armored vehicles of all the different categories, and really anything else, to include even drones. All the stuff that you can put together, most importantly, including the manpower, are on the deficiency side, on the Ukraine side, and on the Russian side. As we've talked about many times, everything is on the top. Manpower, most importantly, defense industrial base, ammunition supplies, stockpiles, missiles, drones, fighter jets, everything you can imagine, air defense systems, much, much more robust on the Russian side and growing. So you would just not expect that the guy who President Trump is trying to get this war over with in this 28-point peace plan, the one who could benefit the most from the war coming to a rapid end, is the one who is now boisterous in saying, no, we're going to keep fighting until we get all these things that we want, even though he has no power to bring it into fruition. So that's kind of the context that this is going in. One of the reasons why the Trump administration is having such a hard time trying to bring this thing to a head and to try to bring it to fruition, because of resistance, not from the Russian side, we're going to get to that in a minute, but from the Western side, and especially the Ukraine side. Maybe not especially, maybe equally, the Ukraine and the European side. They both continue to push back against Trump because they just don't want it. And they are unwilling to just detach from reality to detach from their fantasies, to embrace reality and acknowledge that everything that goes into war making, everything that goes into deciding which side will win a war of attrition in human history. We're not even talking about the modern era, really. It's really in human history. The fundamentals that go into which side wins war are remarkably consistent, even though technology has radically changed over the centuries. But the fundamentals remain the same, and they are in effect now, and they will impose their will, no matter what anybody wants to say and how boisterous you say it, how much, you know, slick words you put on videos and how much cool camera angles and music and all that kind of stuff, which the Ukrainians are really good at. None of that is going to change the reality on the ground. And that's just how this is going to work out. But that's where we are today. And until that final day comes, the fiction will continue to go on, because most of the American public and the Western public are falling for this. I'm just going to call it what it is. They believe it. And as I'm discovered from talking to some sources in both the UK and the United States here just in the last few weeks, to one in the UK earlier this morning, there are people at the highest levels in these governments that actually believe the fiction and think that Russia is on the ropes, and that just a little bit more effort and it will be the Russians, not the Ukrainian side, not the side that's on the deficiency in every category I just mentioned, but somehow it's the guys who were on the superior side will collapse if just we keep going a little bit further. Now, much of that is just ignorance and just unwillingness to acknowledge anything and just saying we'll cling into what we want. Some of it, of course, is pernicious. Some of the people who are proffering these kinds of narratives know exactly what's going on, and they're intentionally deceiving their own people and their own military and political leaders, because they don't want them to recognize reality and end this war, because of whatever nefarious purposes they have. They want the war to continue on because somehow they calculate there's a benefit to them, irrelevant and inconsequential to what happens to the Ukrainian people. But that's where we are. So that's half of the equation. The other half of the equation, Vladimir Putin also made his own comments this week. And he says, oh, by the way, we're still willing to talk, but by the way, this time there is an or.
As I understand, they decided that all 28 points should be grouped into four separate components. We received all this information. In general, we agree that the US-backed peace plan can be used as a basis for future agreements. But it would be impolite on my part to speak about any final versions, because there are none. Ukrainian troops must withdraw from the territories they hold, and then the fighting can cease. If they don't leave, then we shall achieve this by armed means.
It's just categorical, just cut and dried. We're willing to negotiate. We're willing to have a discussion to where we bring this war to a diplomatic end in the near term. We could do it in a few weeks, probably, if both sides were willing to do. But then he adds, or we'll just continue to go forward militarily until we conquer all the territory that we need. That's just what they're saying. They're saying, this is where we're going. And now you can hear these two dueling narratives. And if you just were looking at the narratives alone, if you were just looking at the video, you would think, okay, well, the Ukrainian leader was a little bit even more boisterous and a little bit more decisive and confident in his video statement. And then here's this, you know, Vladimir Putin saying some pretty confident stuff too. What are we to believe? How can we know? Because both sides are saying this, and one side's telling the truth, one side's not. One side's delusional, one side's not, or who knows what, for people who are not paying that much attention. Of course, that's the intention, unfortunately, and that's the desire. But when you look at the reality on the ground, there is only one side whose confident statements are associated with the truth and the reality on the ground. And that, of course, is the Russian side. And it still surprises me to a certain extent that the Russians are still saying they're willing to have a negotiated settlement. But I kind of agree with Larry Johnson on our show earlier this week, where he said he doesn't think that they actually believe that anymore, that they're just saying, hey, we're going to continue showing, which we have from the beginning. And earlier in this war, Russia definitely was interested in a negotiated settlement that would have been, in comparison, radically better for the Ukrainian government and definitely for the Ukrainian people, especially before. You could go all the way back to the Minsk agreements and the things that the Russians were willing to do there, and the control that the Ukraine side would have had over all of its territory minus Crimea. And in fact, if you go back to the 2014 deal that was struck that should have resulted in new elections during the Maidan stuff, the Russians were in agreement to have new elections have in May of 2014. This is on the 20th, I believe, of February 2014, that would have left Kiev. Understand this. Not a lot of people know this. If that agreement had been left in place, and there had been early elections, so just a few months hence from that time, there would have almost certainly, it's a virtual guarantee, there would have been a Western-oriented government And that government in Kiev would have had control over the entire country, to include Crimea, all of it, if only they had let actual democratic norms flow and actually listen to let the people vote. People in the East would still have been unhappy because they wanted the previous government. They didn't want it, but they would have been democratically defeated at the election, at the polls. And all evidence shows that they would have grumbled, but they would have abided by it. And then they would have tried to do better in the next election, et cetera. But the West didn't want to do that. So they sabotaged that deal. And then it was just a couple of weeks later. I think it was March. So it was just a matter of weeks that Russia said, okay, we see that this is not going to work out. And now you're going to continue to move NATO into Ukraine. There's no way we're going to allow our Black Sea Fleet in Sevastopol to fall in under NATO control. So then he annexed the whole thing. So that started the process. Then you had the 8 years basically of civil war. And during the Minsk agreement, starting the following year from that first decision, is that Russia said, okay, we'll stop supporting the conflict here, except on a low level, defensive level. And we'll work on this Minsk agreements, which will then eliminate all the fight, no more military support. And Ukraine, Kiev would have stayed in charge of everything in the Donbas, all of it, all the way up to the Russian border, if they had followed the rules. But they didn't want to. They didn't want to go down the diplomatic path. And then, of course, we know the last chance came in December 2021, when we know because Jens Stoltenberg has admitted it absolutely openly and said, yes, Putin told us that NATO in Ukraine was the non-negotiable and there would be war without that. And we said, of course, we didn't sign that. So, of course, we got the war. Putin did exactly what he said he would do, and we had the war. And then, of course, in February or April, the next opportunity for negotiated settlement, and then ad infinitum all the way through to where we are today. Every time we've had a chance for negotiated settlement, and it's not accepted, the conditions for Ukraine get worse and worse and worse. Why would any rational thinking person believe that this time, after all the massive casualties, the destruction of Ukrainian cities and the loss of the territory, that this time it's going to be different? Even though anyone can see that the balance of power has only increased dramatically from where it was in let's go all the way back, 2014, and then 2015, 2022, and today. The balance of power continues to shift in the Russian side. And now then you want to think that today with the balance much worse than it was in the beginning of this conflict, that somehow it's going to work out now? It's just irrational. But that's where we are, folks. A lot of people have that view. Now, something else happened this week that was made public anyway. It's been bubbling under the surface for a while, but it really blew up this week here that could potentially upset the whole situation anyway and could eventually result in this war coming to an end, whether anybody in the West wants it or not. And that is a political scandal that exploded in Kiev about corruption. And there was, I guess it was a week or so ago, we had one of Zelensky's right-hand men, or one of his left-hand men, one of his close associates that was fled the country because he was being investigated for corruption. Very close ties to Zelensky. Well, this week it was his right-hand man, Andrew Yermak, and Larry Johnson laid that out for us.
It's not allegations. They've actually got evidence that billions of dollars, up to $48 billion, diverted from USAID out of $360 billion over the last almost 4 years. The money went into banks in Estonia, Latvia, up in the Baltics. You wonder why Kaja Kallas of Estonia thinks it's so essential to keep this war going, because that money keeps rolling through. Anyway, a lot of that money was diverted and wound up in banks in the Caribbean, you know, like Cayman Islands, that kind of place. And there were payments made to at least 23 members of the U.S. Congress, both members of the House of Representatives and Senate. And so all I got to do is just sit down and make a list. Who are the most vocal senators and congressmen regarding the war in Ukraine? And guarantee you, they're on the list of people getting paid.
I was communicating earlier today with somebody who has direct ties to the administration in Kiev, and they say that this is having an earthquake type reaction among the people in Ukraine. They're concerned that this could literally bring the whole regime down. How do you see it?
Oh, yeah, I absolutely agree with that. During my last trip to Moscow, I met with a former Ukrainian prosecutor and with the former prime minister, Azarov. of Ukraine, who left office in 2014 after the Maidan. You know, and they were both saying that this corruption is deep, it's endemic, it's tied into the oligarchs who've been, you know, using this as another way for them to make money. So this right now is Zelensky doesn't have a lot of allies to fall back on. He's actually relying upon Europe to try to save his bacon. So this is coming to a head, and people who think that he's going to survive this political crisis and he'll be around for another 2 years. No, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, and it continues to worsen here, and apparently from some who are talking on the inside saying that Andriy Yermak is really upset that he's being cut loose. And Zelensky, in a speech, said, yeah, he's been removed from his position because he wasn't just Zelensky's right-hand man. He wasn't just a guy who was helping him with all of his domestic and international policies. He was also their lead negotiator. So now then that's been replaced by a guy named Budanov, who, by the way, Umarov, who is also being examined for potential corruption. And so you're replacing one corrupt guy with another one under investigation. So that just tells you the nature. I mean, you can't have anybody who's not under some kind of major investigation. I mean, a significant number of the leading group here, of the leaders of the country. And one has to just ask, you know, at what point does the West finally say, okay, we keep using all these words about democracy? You remember all this stuff from this whole war has been about, you know, we're going to uphold the freedom and democracy. And these guys are the ones that are, you know, trying to fight for what we are. They're trying to defend us and our values as a Western alliance. What is the value then, may I ask? Because it kind of looks like it's about cash. I mean, that's what it looks like to me. When you see people that are corrupt at this level, and believe me, folks, believe me, the people in the highest levels of UK, MI6, CIA, the White House, 10 Downing, they know what's been going on. They know that there's been a lot of corruption going on. So this is not new to them. It's just now it's made it out into the public. At what point do we finally just say, all right, we're not even going to pretend like we're actually, you know, going for democracy and morality and the rule of law, all this kind of stuff, and just say, yeah, we just hate Russia. And so we're going to go after it no matter what. And we're going to tolerate all these guys. And just think also about the money that's involved here, because it doesn't come out of nowhere. It's money that could be used in all of these different countries where it's coming from. And they're spending it ostensibly and allegedly to defend the heroic fighters of Ukraine. And to be clear, the actual fighters in Ukraine who are being sacrificed on the altar of whatever it is that they're trying to do in Brussels, they are fighting heroically, and they deserve, and they have my highest admiration and respect. It is astounding what they have accomplished under the circumstances here, but their circumstances can't end up positive. So when you see all these guys from Brussels, London, Paris, Washington, et cetera, when they just keep going down this path of shoveling out the cash and knowing that a ton of it is not going to actually defending the troops on the ground, not providing what they need to actually fight, but it's actually going into somebody else's pocket. And apparently, at least lots of allegations that a lot of it is in Zelensky's pocket. Now, I can't validate that myself. All I can tell you is what's being read. But when you see guys at the highest level, and don't forget the defense minister, I want to say it was about the year and a half mark of Ukraine, had already resigned because of a corruption scandal, been fired, actually. No, he wasn't resigned. He had been fired by Zelensky for corruption. So this is not new. At the highest levels I'm talking about. Now it's come out from their internal sources, and there's a lot of speculation of why it burst out. Now, was it something that some Western leaders are saying, hey, we're using this to try to get your attention, to get you to have a negotiated settlement, or whether it's just some people inside Ukraine that just said, finally, we've had enough, and I don't care what anybody says, here's the truth. Unknown at this point. There's evidence it could be either one of them, so we'll have to wait and see how time works out on that one. But the bottom line is that we do know for certain that this stuff is out there right now. So we can't claim we don't know anymore. And the Western countries can't claim that this is all about democracy when you see it's all about corruption and all about cash at the highest levels, certainly. So now we have to decide, what are you going to do about it? Are you going to continue to turn a blind eye? Are you going to continue to say, well, It's just the cost of doing business, and especially because some of our guys benefit from the cost of this business, so works for me. I think you know where it's probably going to head, but that's not where it should be going. Let's now shift gears over to the Russian side of this, because that's kind of what's been going on from the Ukraine and the Western side. But from the Russian side, we had Andrei Mardyanov, who's a military expert on the Russian military, and he was answering a couple of questions about one about why Russia is moving so slow. And we actually have two entries on that this week, interestingly enough. But he's also talking about how Russia is still focused on the root causes.
Obviously, there will be no freezing of the conflict. So militarily, Europe is done. They are impotent militarily. Without United States, there are literally nobodies. Essentially, there is now what is happening on the front line. It's a sporadic. It becomes to what is called Achagovaya. Achagovaya means they're enclosed into one locality, not complete continuous front. And as you saw yourself, what is happening all over the place, there are breakthroughs. And Russians are not in rush, really. They don't have to be. And as a result, we have what we have. These 28 points, out of those 28 points, very many will be rejected, already have been rejected by Russia. Russian position is well known. Even such criminal organization as Wall Street Journal actually admitted yesterday that, yeah, Russian strategy, people don't understand. It wasn't the strategy. These were political aims which have been actually put forward, and they never changed. You know, so those root causes, so to speak, they remain the critical point, the foundation on which Russia's going to be talking to anybody. If they do not address root causes, there you go. And Vladimir Putin is absolutely correct when he stated that, yeah, it's a criminal regime. It's a Nazi regime. So it's not a territory coveted by Kremlin. It is the political annihilation, essentially, of the current regime, and it will be annihilated.
And that's he's basically just repeating what Vladimir Putin himself said in one of the soundbites we showed from earlier this week, where Putin just flat out said, he said on that one soundbite, we did say we're going to take this at the negotiating table or in the field of battle. But subsequently, Putin also had a statement when he was wearing military uniforms where he said, listen, the Ukraine is just a criminal regime and they're not valid. And we won't even talk to Zelensky. So they're getting more emphatic on the illegality as from the Russian perspective of the Kiev regime and on the fact that they will take it on the battlefield, because that's what they have the capacity to do. They recognize the same things that we already do and the things that we've shown you on the front line. And, you know, Andrei was just reiterating what the Russian side continues to say. And, you know, let's take a look at some of that here. This is this is one of the key boasts. Remember, I've been telling you for many months that Russia, it's about 3 or 4 months ago, classified this as the priority effort, the Pokrovsk area, in the entire front. And they, even though they've been trying for, I want to say it's like 18 months or something, it wasn't a lot of progress. They made a lot of progress, kind of came up and kind of came up to the outskirts of Pokrovsk. You may recall that there was some of the areas where they'd been kind of back in here and they got really close, President Shevchenko, et cetera. They were kind of back here and then they stayed there for many months and couldn't close the gap. But then about 3 or 4 months ago, they made a conscious effort to say, all right, we're going to prioritize taking Pokrovsk. And now you see, the city itself is effectively all taken. And now then you also see that Mirnograd, it's being engulfed from the south, from the west. And then now it's literally surrounded all place. There is now no more escape. And the only way that these forces on the inside can be resupplied is from whatever they may have had before the gate closed. And then whatever they can get with drones, that's the other way they can get it. But you can't do that for very long and be able to keep these folks alive. So it's only a matter of time until these folks in here are either all destroyed or are surrendered. There's apparently no other alternative. I'm sure that the Ukraine side may attempt to have them break them out, but all the attempts they've been making for the past 2 months have all failed. And you see even Rodinska, which I've mentioned here a number of times, is now almost completely again back in Russian hands completely. And you may recall these areas of Shakhova, et cetera. Again, all these are in Russian hands. So it's pretty significant that they continue going in this direction. And then let's take a look here because I'm going to show you a comment here that was really instructive by General Aptia Ludinov, which was the Russian general that was responsible for clearing out the Kursk objective, a salient that 7 or 8 month foray that the Ukraine side foolishly did that cost them 70,000 troops and gained them absolutely nothing. But he's now one of the leading generals here, and he's very much involved in what's going on in the Russian front. In an interview with Dmitry Symes Jr., he explained what was going on in the front line. So as context, before I show you his comments, I want to show you some of the current situation here in this 1,000-kilometer front. And you see that starting down here in the Zaporizhia area, this is where Russia has been making another push now, a new push in this direction here. So you see they're moving up not far from the outskirts of the city of Zaporizhia itself. So he's putting that under control. And then you see that they're going out on Yulipolia. You see, we've been talking about this one too. There's continued Russian advances all the way along this. They're just right up to the outskirts here, and they're continuing to close the gap to cut off in Dobropila here, the access road. So now then there's limited roads of resupply, because you see that there's north and south routes into Yulipolia, but not any good lateral routes. There's a few small ones here, but those are under fire control visibility by the Russian side. So it's very, very difficult to get this place supplied. And then you just can keep going up all the way up on the line. And you see that the Russians are continuing to move forward. We talked about the Pokrovsk already. The Konstantinivka, the Russians are continuing to make progress into the southern parts of that. And we just continue to go all the way up the line up to, you see the new areas of red there. That means Russia's advanced in the last 12 hours. And of course, in Kupiansk, it's all but fallen to the Russian side. Kharkiv all the way into here. Volchansk, the Russians have effectively taken Volchansk. And now you see they're even moving further south than that. So now then, with that kind of as a setup, that's what the 1,000-kilometer front line actually looks like. And here is General Apti actually talking about what the Russian strategy is.
You have to look at the line of defense, the line of contact. It's over 1,000 kilometers long. And across this entire 1,000-kilometer line, we're conducting active offensive operations in various sectors, destroying the enemy's resources in the process. If you take into account that the forms and methods of warfare have changed today, the main damage the enemy inflicts on us, and we on them, is done by unmanned aerial vehicles. Does it make sense for us to make sudden moves and lose a lot of people? Of course not. We're advancing steadily, gradually eroding and destroying the enemy's forces and assets. And today, we can say we've brought them to a state where they're about to crumble. But if we'd made a sharp breakthrough and surged forward, we'd have lost a huge number of people. Should we consider that a victory? No. Because the situation shows we need to preserve our personnel as much as possible, keep advancing without giving the enemy a breather, but at the same time, we have to be ready for NATO forces to join the conflict at any moment.
That last part there, I think, is more important than many recognize, and something I really wanted to highlight. And that is, he said, we don't want to have a breakthrough and have suffer a lot of casualties. That's just kind of a decision that can be made, you know, the go slow versus the big arrow movement kind of thing. Because if you try big arrow naturally and you flood a lot of people in a concentrated place, that makes it easier for the opponent to kill them because one drone can take out many if you have them concentrated up in there. So just on the surface of it, that makes sense from the side that has the advantage in firepower. But he also says we're trying to preserve our personnel because in case that there is a conflict with NATO, that tells you that the Russians are focused on the possibility that there could be conflict and there could be war between NATO and Russia, not a hopper or a conflict where they're using the proxy war, Ukraine as the cudgel, but actually a conflict between the East and the West. And listen, this is something that the West always tells you, that the Russians are coming for us. They're coming for us next, and we have to stop here at Ukraine because they're like the front line for all of us, keeping all of us safe, and they'll come to us next, etc. There's going to be war by 2029. German forces have said this just in the past week or so. French are saying the same. Of course, Poland is sounding the alarm. The Baltics, Sweden, several other countries, especially those who are around Russia. They keep warning that that's going to happen. And obviously, you have Secretary General Mark Rutte continues to say, yes, we have to get ready for Russia. There won't be peace with Russia even after this war is solved. We still have to get ready for that, et cetera. Russia's listening to that. And as I said on an interview on Mariel Nafal, I did a debate with the General Ben Hodges. And that was one of the things that they tried to get me on. They said, oh, well, they're definitely coming. I said, listen, you have this dynamic. And one of the reasons why I am so emphatic, maybe the reason why I'm the most emphatic, that this war needs to come to an end, because the longer it goes on, the longer you have a chance that this eventually escalates and goes beyond the borders of Ukraine. And it could draw in the West through Article 5, whether that's through an error, miscalculation, or just stupidity. Can't eliminate that as a possibility anymore either. And when you have a lots of boisterous talk and you step up here, this is one of the things that too few in the West are willing to even acknowledge exists. You cannot take actions against an adversary that is a superpower, and especially a nuclear superpower, but also a conventional superpower, an energy superpower, and not expect there to be a reaction. You want to take action? You think that it's going to be good? You better expect a counteraction. And the same with Russia. Because when the NATO does something and the NATO makes actions, then the Russians make a counteraction. And then when their NATO sees this, then they take a counteraction and so forth. And we keep getting this one rung up the potential escalation ladder. And now here we are. So the Russians are seeing that NATO is on a rebuild Europe program, where everybody's going to increase their defense spending from some below 1% up to 5%. In a decade, and they're going to be ramping it up in between now and then. And they see, like, Germany saying they want to be the preeminent military conventional power on the continent. When they see UK saying how they're going to reinforce and build up their forces, France, etc. I mean, all these countries, Poland, they keep seeing all this. They're going to build up. Germany itself has already forward deployed forces into the Baltic area. When Russia sees that, they take counteractions. And now then they see, hey, this could work against us, and we may end up having to fight. So let's preserve our troops now. Let's continue to build up stockpiles of all the weapons that are needed, both missiles and air defense missiles that are necessary to win a war of attrition against a superpower of a NATO alliance. That's what they're doing as well. So right now you got both sides kind of ramping up. But one of the things I try to tell all my Western colleagues and fellow Natonians, listen, we can't fight a war with Russia. You think that they're weak and that they're fallen, but yet their defense industrial base is miles and literal years ahead of where we are. We've incrementally increased some production levels. We have contracts to do some other stuff, but it's still on a peacetime level. It's not a 24/7, 365 operation like it is in Russia, because it's a literal existential fight for them. It still isn't for us. It's mainly about money. It's mainly about making profit. And so we have ramped up, and they've been happy to ramp up because that makes more profit, but it's been incremental. It hasn't been big. And when you look at the amount of weapons and ammunition, especially, even more so than tanks, planes, armor personnel carriers, howitzers, all that kind of stuff, those things are important. But what is the most important issue outside of manpower, which I keep telling you, that's the most important thing. But right after that, in order to fight a war of attrition in the modern area, you've got to have a defense industrial base to sustain combat over a period of time, and I'm talking an extended period of time, measured in years. If you can't sustain war for a long period of time, logistically, that means large numbers of artillery shells, large numbers of drones, large numbers of long-range missiles, large numbers of anti-aircraft missiles, air interceptor missiles, etc. Unless you can maintain those and at a sustained rate, that means that you can use them at a high level and still have more to be putting in there. You cannot fight and win a war like that. And unless you're very foolishly thinking, well, if we start running low, we'll just switch to nukes. I fear some may be thinking that. Of course, then it's game over, folks, for everybody. So anybody in the West who may think that we can win a war against Russia, and if the conventional starts to fall, we'll just switch over to nukes, and then we'll show them. And of course, then Russia will back down because they won't want to, you know, face all of our nuclear weapons. Why do you think that Russia would do that when you won't? Seriously. I mean, it's just self-evident. If you want to argue that well, if we threaten to use nuclear weapons, then they'll back down when you wouldn't. Because the exact same thing, in fact, they've even got more of them. The same dynamic exists on the other side, and they'll certainly apply the same logic. Well, we'll use more nuclear weapons, and then that will cause them to recognize the futility, and then they won't do it. And if anyone does, then the other will react. And life as we've known it will come to an end, even if it's not a mutually assured destruction, even if somehow it stays limited. The life as we know it today will no longer exist and will never get back. It will be a completely new world, terrifying new realities, and everyone will live in fear of annihilation. That's the truth of it. It's not hard to figure out here. And that is what concerns me so much that, and I'm not worried about the Russian side. They've got their own folks to worry about that. I am very much worried about our side on the West. And there is every reason in the world that we can get this war off the table and get the risk of escalation off the table too and be done with it and just get back to normal relations and our normal defensive posture, our normal conventional forces, our normal strategic nuclear forces will keep us safe as long as the threat of conventional war is off the table, because Russia's not going to commit suicide. They've shown that throughout the entire history of their nuclear forces. They do not want to use nuclear weapons as a means of self-destruction. They're only going to use them in the case that they have to, as they see fit. Like it had been the case that mutually assured destruction kept everyone from doing it as long as everyone was sane. Now, if we get to the point to where things that are not rational start getting used, then you got a whole new situation here. So we need to get this war over with as soon as possible to bring us back off the brink, get back off the edge, and move us further down these rungs that I talked about. And with some sane policy on both sides, we can still get there. So it's not too late. It's not irreversible at this point, but it will require a change of momentum, because where we are headed has a bad outcome and a bad ending. So we need to get some sanity while we still can. One other thing I want to talk to you about this week, and that's something that's been happening here in the United States. There was an article in the Washington Post just last night. Actually, I'm going to bypass those, Gary. I'm just going to go straight to the Washington Post here. This came out last night. Said that the title here you see, Hegseth order on the first Caribbean boat strike, officials said, kill them all. And according to the Washington Post, Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth gave the spoken directive, according to two people with direct knowledge of the operation. This is talking about the very first attack in September, the very first of these attacks. And there's been 80 some odd people and 20 something attacks up to this point. But on the first one, it says that the order was given to kill everybody. One of them said a missile screamed off the Trinidad coast, striking the vessel and igniting a blaze from bow to stern. For minutes, commanders watched the boats burning on live drone feed. As the smoke cleared, they got a jolt. Two survivors were clinging onto the smoldering wreck. The special operations commander overseeing the September 2nd attack ordered a second strike to comply with Hegseth's instructions, two people familiar with the matter said. The two men were blown apart in the water. Now, that is a very, very incendiary statement. So far, we only have the Washington Post to agree, you know, whether this happened or not. But I'll just tell you, if it happened the way they said here, you have a serious, serious situation to where the Secretary of War has violated the Geneva Conventions that we're party to, the Geneva Conventions 3 of 1949, where it specifically says that you can't do that. You can't kill prisoners of war. You can't kill people that are wounded and no longer have the ability to resist. The Geneva Conventions also very specifically say it's not just guys who are wearing uniforms, but even in these kinds of operations here where you designate somebody a terrorist, whatever, the laws of war still apply in that case. So that's what's at stake here, that you could literally be a war crime from the Secretary of Defense, according to what's reacted here. Now, My guess was that the Secretary of State, I'm sorry, Secretary of War, Hegseth, would deny that it happened. So say, oh, that's just fake news. It's a hoax. That's kind of what the administration does. But to my surprise, that's not what he said. In fact, if anything, he doubled down. This is from last night on his own direct ex post, this official statement from the Secretary of War himself. I'm going to read the whole thing here because it's really, really illustrative and important. As usual, the fake news is delivering more fabricated, inflammatory, and derogatory reporting to discredit our incredible war fighting to protect the homeland. So at the first paragraph, I thought, oh, okay, well, there it is. He's going to deny it. But we continue. As we've said from the beginning and in every statement, these highly effective strikes are specifically intended to be, quote, lethal kinetic strikes. The declared intent is to stop lethal drugs, destroy narco boats, and kill the narco terrorists who are poisoning the American people. Every trafficker we kill is affiliated with a designated terrorist organization. The Biden administration preferred kid gloves approach, allowing millions of people, the dangerous cartels and unvetted Afghans. By the way, he included the Afghans because he wants to tie into the murder of one of these National Guard troops in Washington, D.C. here just a couple of days ago, who died, I guess, the day before yesterday, very, very tragically. And wants to say an unvetted Afghan. Well, as it turns out, by the way, just kind of parenthetically here, it was not unvetted. As a matter of fact, it was vetted by the Trump administration and worked with the CIA and validated as being an approved person that cleared vetting. So can't blame that one on Biden in any case. Continuing, to flood our communities with drugs and violence, the Trump administration has sealed the border and gone on offense against narco-terrorists. Biden coddled terrorists. We kill them, he boasts again. And he said, our current operations in the Caribbean are lawful under both U.S. and international law, with all actions in compliance with the law of armed conflict and approved by the best military and civilian lawyers up and down the chain of command. Our warriors in Southcom put their lives on the line every day to protect our homeland from narco terrorists, and I will always have their back. Okay, so you just putting on an ex post that this is lawful under both U.S. and international law doesn't make it so. As a matter of fact, it doesn't have any impact at all. And let's take a look at it. I mentioned the Geneva Convention. This is Law 47. Gary, if you can put that one up there real quick. This is from the part of the Geneva Convention. It's called the International Humanitarian Law, which is a portion of the 1949 Geneva Conventions, which we are signatory to, which says attacks against persons whores to combat. They're going to explain what that in a minute is prohibited. A person whores to combat is A, anyone who is in the power of an adverse party. B, anyone who is defenseless because of unconsciousness, shipwreck, wounds, or sickness, or anyone who clearly expresses an intent to surrender, provided he or she abstains from hostile act and does not attempt to escape. Under those conditions, you cannot kill them, period. Black and white. So I don't care what any handpicked lawyer you had claims to the contrary. It is a black and white statement. You attacked a shipwreck. There were two survivors. They very much wanted to live. And you fired another volley intentionally by name, by direct order of the Secretary of War himself to kill them. What does that tell you? I mean, just because you have a lawyer said, yeah, sure, it's legal, then you have to explain to us how the actual law that is very clear and concise, it's not complicated, specifically says a shipwreck even. It talks about that. And then you saw a shipwreck and you saw a survivor and you killed him. That is at face value a war crime. And at the very least, it should be investigated as such. And obviously nobody in the administration is going to be capable of doing that because they have already reached a conclusion. Everything they do is legal and that no one can question. So no one will question it in the administration. But look, folks, this is, again, something we've been talking about, unfortunately, too many times on this show because too many events like this happen. Because the United States is to the point to where we can no longer credibly say we're a country governed by the rule of law. And so we get mocked to our face when we say these things about we're trying to support the international rules-based order. The order since the end of World War II, 80 years we've been doing it. You know, we try to hold other people accountable. We get mocked to our face. Nobody pays attention to us. Nobody is going to listen to us and act because we say, oh, you're violating the international rules-based order, when we ourselves blatantly do so and then brag about it, like Secretary Hegseth did in that ex post. Unfortunately, it's not just the Secretary of War. It's also his boss, who around the same time as this was happening was asked, hey, you keep going after all these boats. And at least according to the Constitution, you're supposed to have the authority of Congress by declaring war or giving written authorization. Are you going to seek that? And he said very simply,
I don't think we're going to necessarily ask for a declaration of war. I think we're just going to kill people that are bringing drugs into our country. Okay, we're going to kill them.
There's not much confusion there. No, we're going to kill them. We don't care what the law is. We don't care what our Constitution says. We don't care what the international law says. And listen, you know, you by saying, oh, well, they're narco terrorists. So that gives us the justification to kill anyone. That's just a look. No one can do what I say they can't. Okay, do you see that? I just wrote that here, right there. No one can do what I say they can't. So I wrote it down. So now if I'm in the administration, that becomes law, right? Just because I said it. So there it is. The problem solved. It doesn't work that way. I also can't write, it is, I hereby declare that I can rob a bank and get all the money that I want and no one can do anything about it. Signed, whatever, have some title that I'm going to come up with, even if it's President of the United States. I have declared that I don't have to pay taxes anymore because I don't want to. It doesn't matter what you write down. You can write down anything in the world. You can write down that from now on, by executive order, the sun will no longer come up in the east. We're going to make it come up in the west. Tired of this. I want to change things up. It doesn't matter. The sun will come up in the east. This will be illegal. The bank will hold you accountable if you try to do that. We can't just sign a document and sign a piece of paper and just arbitrarily claim that the law no longer is in effect or that, yeah, this doesn't apply here. It does apply. Now, it also matters what you can do and what you can't do. And what we can do is violate the law at will, because who's going to stop us? Right now, the situation, this is what exists. We've got to be honest about it, is that the President of the United States, who is leading this with that declaration I just showed you that he made from his own lips, that we're just going to kill him. So, of course, the Secretary of Defense is not going to say, I'm sorry, Mr. President, we can't do that, because that would be violating the laws of international warfare. It would be violating the Geneva Conventions, and it would be violating American law. Because, as you may know, that there is no law on any book in any state in this country, federal or state or local, that says someone who is trafficking in drugs can be executed at the suspicion of drawing drugs. If you think somebody's drawing drugs and you have intelligence, perfect intelligence, that these are drug runners, there still is no justification whatsoever on any law in American jurisprudence that allows you to summarily execute these people. And just say, oh, well, we just had the narco-terrorist. We have now declared that they're a terrorist, so now we can kill them at will. No, you can't. You can't rationally, logically, legally do it. Now, you can say, I have the power. Who's going to stop me? It's not going to be the president. It's not going to be the Secretary of War. It's not going to be the FBI director. It's not going to be the Attorney General, because they're as loyalist as you get. It's not going to be the CIA director. None of them. Nobody who has any potential authority is going to do a thing. And then now what? Politically? I mean, the Republican Party is clearly not going to do anything, whether in the House or the Senate. And if anybody in the Democrat House or the Senate wants to, they don't have any numbers. They don't have any power. So they can't. I mean, they can at least posture and at least say, we're going to do what we can within our power. They could do something like that. So far, they haven't. But no one else can. Whoever may be listening to this video and say, yeah, it's right there. It's black and white. This is not governed by the rule of law. This is governed by the rule of power. Those who have the power make the rules. It's trite, but it is on full display right before your eyes right here. This is not the country that I served for 20-something years in the armed services. This is not the kind of government that I signed up to put my life literally on the line for through my four combat deployments. And I find it repugnant what we have become. And again, it bears mention, this is not just the Trump administration. This is not just some screed against them. This is the American government. This has been going on for a long time. I mean, we can at least run back to George Bush, Barack Obama, Joe Biden, Trump in the first term, Trump in the second term. All of them have been doing this to one level. No, nobody's taking it as far as he can. See, and that's the problem. You start off down here and then you get bold because nobody calls you out on it. Nobody holds you accountable. So then you go just a little bit further and then a little bit further and still no reaction. And now then you got Trump just like, I don't care what any of y'all say. I'll just write it on a piece of paper here. I said, it's cool. So it's his, no more question. This is the law. This is now the law because I said it, President Trump, Secretary of War, that trumps any law that may exist before. And he can, he did. And so far, at least as of today, that was in yesterday's Washington Post. I haven't seen anything this morning. I didn't see any headlines that said anybody's going to hold him accountable and we're going to stop doing this. So it'll continue going on. But listen to me carefully, folks. There is a consequence to this, whether you want there to be one or not. There will eventually be consequences to this. Because you can't just continue to violate the law and then think you're going to stop there. I've just shown you. It continues, has already continued to escalate. Now it's escalating faster. We're shorn of any kind of authority that no one's going to hold you accountable. Where's the upper limit? They'll continue to take more actions and impugn other people. We saw President Trump just, I guess, a day or so ago, send out a Truth Social, says he's now considering, not considering, he said he's going to take away citizenship of people who are not, as he defines it, sufficiently pro-American. Who even knows what that means? Apparently only Donald Trump, but he has now set in place this situation to where he is now going to decide who even gets to keep their citizenship. There's no law for that. There's no justice for that. And it's just the whims of one man, but who's stopping him? You see what I'm saying here? This is going to continue on, folks. This is a dangerous development. And if we're going to be a country governed by the rule of law, even ostensibly, some changes are going to have to be made, or one day we're all going to be silenced. The minute that you run afoul of the administration in something, you'll be on the hit list there. And it won't matter what the law is. It won't matter if they have any legal justification or if you violated any law. It won't make any difference. That's just how it's going to work. That's how it has worked up to this point. And we are fooling ourselves if we think that this is the end. Well, it won't go any further than this. It never stops, folks, until something stops it. You either follow the rule of law or you follow the rule of a dictator. It's as simple as that. That's your show for today. I appreciate you guys being with us. As always, we are unintimidated and uncompromised to bring you the truth. No matter what it is, no matter where it lies, we're going to bring you the truth. Look forward to seeing you next week because we got a lot of good guests for you and a lot of things are going to probably be happening even over the weekend. Believe me, Monday morning, we'll get right back to you on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.